Welcome to today's deep dive. We're on a very specific mission for you today.
We really are.
Yeah, we're talking about understanding and, more importantly, disarming your inner saboteur. Because, we all have those moments where we just fall into unhelpful habits.
Oh, absolutely.
Like when you hear that really persistent voice of self-doubt, or when a massive wave of harsh self-criticism just kind of washes over you out of nowhere.
Right, which happens to everyone.
Exactly. So today we are exploring a pretty radical strategy for handling those exact moments, and we're drawing all our insights today from the RAF program.
And just to set the stage for you here, the insights we're exploring today belong to a much broader structure. It's known as the RAFT framework.
And we should clarify, that's spelled RAFT, but pronounced exactly like the word raft.
Yes, exactly like a raft, like the actual vessel you'd build to navigate turbulent waters, which I think is a great image.
The perfect image, honestly.
So RAFT is an acronym, and it stands for Recognize, Abandon, Feel, and Train. It's this really comprehensive system for dealing with patterns of self-sabotage.
But we aren't going through all four steps today, right?
Right, no. Today, we're planting ourselves firmly at the very beginning of that journey. We're going to focus entirely on just that first step, which is recognize.
Because, until you can clearly see the underlying urges that are pulling you off course.
You can't do anything else. You literally cannot abandon a harmful behavior or train a new one if you don't even know what's happening.
So true. So to set up that recognize step, I actually want you, the listener, to imagine a scenario for a second.
Oh, I like this one.
Yeah. So imagine you're walking through your house late at night and you are absolutely convinced there's an intruder outside.
Right. So you're on high alert.
Exactly. You're locking the doors. You're checking the alarm system, barricading the windows. You're completely bracing for an attack from the outside.
But the twist is,
the threat isn't outside at all. The threat is actually the architect who built the house in the first place.
Which is terrifying.
Right. They design all these secret passages you don't even know about, and they're already inside the walls. They're subtly moving your furniture around, changing the locks, and like actively trying to steer your decisions while you sleep.
The call is coming from inside the house.
Exactly. It's the ultimate inside job.
And that's such a crucial shift in perspective. Because when we talk about navigating unhelpful habits or these really deeply ingrained patterns of self-sabotage, our default assumption is almost always that the triggers are external.
Right. Like, oh, I had a stressful day, or my boss is a difficult person, or I'm just in a bad environment.
Exactly. But the RASH program asks us to turn our attention completely inward, right toward that architect living in the walls.
And I love that the program uses this brilliant ancient metaphor to basically give a face to that architect. It introduces us to this figure known as Mara.
Mara, yes.
So if we want to figure out how to use this first step of the RAFT framework, we really have to understand exactly what we're looking for. Like, who is Mara?
Well, to understand Mara, we actually have to look back to early Buddhist texts.
Okay, taking a historical angle.
Right. And in those teachings, Mara is the literal personification of temptation, of delusion, and craving.
Wow.
He is basically the embodiment of our universal instinctual drives to just protect, promote, and satisfy ourselves in the short term, completely regardless of the long-term cost.
So Mara essentially is the personification of self-sabotage.
Precisely. And he's incredibly subtle, he's cunning, and he usually shows up as those really highly persuasive whispers in your mind.
Oh, I know those whispers.
We all do. They're the whispers that try to convince you to just give in to old familiar patterns, you know, or to avoid doing things that actually require effort. Or they just rationalize completely unhelpful actions.
Yeah, it's that voice that hits you at like 6 p.m. on a Tuesday.
Yep, the Tuesday afternoon slump.
Exactly. And the voice says, you know what? You've had an impossible day. You're exhausted. You deserve to just completely check out and engage in that harmful behavior you swore you were going to stop.
Right. It's very convincing.
Or it's the voice that creates instant self-doubt. It whispers, hey, this new project isn't going to work anyway. And honestly, you aren't smart enough to pull it off. So why even try?
And here is a really profound historical detail from the texts regarding Gautama, the Buddha.
Oh, yeah.
The text shows something super striking about the nature of this inner voice. Mara actually appeared more often after Gautama's awakening than before.
Wait, really? That feels completely counterintuitive.
Right. You'd think it'd be the opposite.
Yeah, we tend to think that if someone achieves a state of profound clarity or, awakening, all their internal struggles just magically evaporate.
But they don't.
Right. So this suggests that awakening is really just like finally turning on a high-powered floodlight in a really messy room.
Oh, I love that analogy. Like, the mess was always there, hidden in the shadows, but now you can actually see every single piece of it with high-definition clarity.
Yes.
So the clarity didn't remove the temptation at all, it simply illuminated it.
That is the crucial distinction right there. Gotama didn't suddenly exist in this magical vacuum free from human urges.
Right.
But what changed was his reaction to them. He didn't violently struggle with Mara. He didn't try to repress him or banish him. He simply saw the urge clearly and named it.
Just named it.
Yeah. And we see this throughout the early texts with awakened monks and nuns as well. There is this famous story of Vijaya Thari.
Okay.
And when Mara attempted to tempt her with this overwhelming pull of sights and sounds and smells and tastes, basically the sensory overload that usually triggers our deepest cravings, she didn't panic.
She didn't try to fight it off?
No, she didn't try to forcefully suppress the urge at all. She just recognized the illusion of what was happening, and she literally said out loud, "Mara, I know you."
Wow. And according to the text, the moment she did that, the illusion just instantly collapsed, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Mara grew sad and disappointed because his cover was blown and he just slipped away.
I mean, it's an incredible story, but I do have to push back on this approach just a little bit for a modern listener.
Okay, let's hear it.
Because if I'm a professional, say, sitting in a high-stress corporate environment, right?
Right.
And I feel a massive wave of anxiety or an urge to engage in a harmful habit, why on earth would I personify it as a mythological character? It feels almost, I don't know, theatrical.
It does sound a bit theatrical.
Like, why not just be logical and say, I am experiencing a negative thought right now, or I'm having a biological urge?
Well, it might feel theatrical at first, sure, but there is a profound psychological mechanism at play here. It's the mechanism of disidentification.
Disidentification.
Yeah. So when you say, I am having a terrible thought, or I want to do this unhelpful thing, your identity is still deeply fused with the urge.
Ah, I see.
It feels like you are the one generating the self-sabotage, which instantly triggers shame and guilt. But when you personify it as a visitor, as Mara, you prove to your brain that this pattern of escape is just an impersonal conditioned reflex.
So it completely separates the observer from the object being observed.
Exactly. Seeing it as an external visitor totally drains its power. It takes what usually feels like this violent, high-stakes internal battle where you're basically fighting yourself and transforms it into a process of calm, objective awareness.
Like you're just watching a weather system pass through your mind.
Yes, beautifully put.
That makes a lot of sense. It creates a necessary distance. But okay, how do we actually operationalize this?
Right, how we use it?
Because moving from ancient texts to a Tuesday afternoon where a craving hits you like a freight train, that requires a toolkit.
It definitely does.
And the RAF program bridges this gap by turning the name into an actionable guide using the acronym M-A-R. Right, M-A-R.
Yes, M-R-A. Let's walk through how this actually functions in real time. So the M stands for mindful, and this is the absolute foundation. It's the practice of basically remembering to remember.
Remembering to remember.
Yeah, it means bringing your present moment awareness to the surface so you can actually spot the urge the exact moment it arrives in your body or mind. You're simply noting, ah, okay, a familiar sensation is here.
Okay, so mindfulness gets me to spot the urge. I notice, you know, my heart rate is elevated, my chest feels tight, and my mind is racing toward a distraction.
Right.
But just staring at my elevated heart rate isn't going to fix anything. So what do I actually do with that raw observation?
And that leads directly to the A, which stands for awareness.
Okay.
So where mindfulness spots the object, awareness reads the context of the situation. And it does this using a very specific tool, which is friendly curiosity.
Friendly curiosity.
Yes. You investigate the urge by asking yourself, is this an old familiar pattern? What's driving this right now? And what would feeding this pattern actually cost me in the long run?
I want to pause on that phrase for a second. Friendly curiosity. Because if I'm having a massive craving to engage in a pattern of self-sabotage, my default state is usually panic or, you know, frustration or anger at myself for feeling weak. So why is curiosity so important here?
It's all because of how the brain's nervous system operates. You literally cannot simultaneously be in a state of high stress threat response, which is what panic and shame trigger, and a state of open, friendly curiosity.
Oh, wow.
They utilize entirely different neural pathways. So when you apply curiosity to your own craving, you are physically forcing your nervous system to stand down from a fight or flight state.
That is fascinating. So we have the raw observation, and then we apply context and curiosity.
Right.
But even with that, there is still an intense physical momentum to a habit.
Yeah.
The inertia is just pulling you forward. How do you break that momentum?
That is the R response.
Response, good.
Crucially, this means choosing to respond rather than reacting automatically. This is where you create a vital, intentional pause. Yeah, and in that pause, you remember that you are not your thoughts, and you are definitely not your urges. You create a physical and mental gap between the stimulus and your action.
Which buys you the necessary time to do what exactly? Like, make a choice.
Yes. Which brings us perfectly to the final A, appropriately. You choose to act appropriately.
Got it. M-A-R-A.
Right. Because you've created that pause, you're now in a position to choose a response that is wise and kind, completely devoid of self-criticism.
And what does that look like in practice?
Well, that might mean utilizing a pre-planned coping strategy, like going for a walk, calling a friend, or honestly just sitting there observing the thought until it dissipates without acting on it at all.
And this actually ties into a concept in modern psychology that the RAFT program highlights, which draws heavily on the work of psychiatrist Dr. Judson Brewer.
Yeah, it's a great concept.
The concept is called inviting Mara to tea. And the premise is that instead of suppressing a difficult emotion or a sudden urge, you just become the calm host.
The host, exactly.
Like the urge shows up, kicks down your door, and says, I am stressed out, I am overwhelmed, and I need this distraction right now.
And you don't fight it.
Right. Instead of wrestling the intruder, you reply, I understand you're stressed, but your solution only leads to more pain. I know you, Mara, and I'm just going to choose to sit here with you.
It is a radical shift in perspective. You're validating the presence of the feeling without validating the behavioral solution it's demanding.
I mean, I love the theory of this. I really do.
But
if I am in the thick of a really powerful compulsion, my brain is screaming at me to act. How does simply acknowledging the urge, saying, I know you, physically stop the train from leaving the station?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm missing the mechanical link here.
You know, you are hitting on the most common point of friction for anyone trying this. It sounds too passive, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
But the secret is that the pause is the power. By internally saying, Mara, I know you, you fundamentally alter the geometry of your mind.
How so?
You're no longer possessed by the thought. Naming it restores your agency. It proves that you don't actually have to white-knuckle your way through your desires, relying on willpower, which always, always depletes.
Willpower definitely runs out.
Right. Instead, you are systematically abandoning the illusion that giving in to the desire offers a real, lasting solution.
So let's look at the actual mechanics under the hood here. Because when I was reviewing the RAFT program materials, I was fascinated by the neuroscience behind this.
Oh, the neuroscience is incredible.
Specifically, the role of a brain network called the default mode network, or the DMN.
Yes, the DMN.
From what I gather, the DMN is essentially our brain's internal narrator. When we aren't focused on a specific demanding task, the DMN defaults to self-referential thought. It ruminates on the past, worries about the future, and basically constructs our sense of self.
That is an excellent summary of the DMN's role. And it does not act alone.
Right.
You know. When a craving hits, it also activates very specific brain regions, particularly the insula and the anterior cingulate cortex. Mm-hmm. And these areas are deeply tied to our ability to sense physiological urges in the body. So the tightness in the chest, the restlessness.
Oh, I see.
So your insula is basically screaming that you are uncomfortable. And your default mode network is spinning this massive convincing narrative that the only way to fix the discomfort is to engage in your harmful habit.
Wow. It's like a perfect storm of biology and storytelling.
It really is.
But how does saying, I know you, change that physical reality in the brain?
Well, this is where neuroimaging provides just incredible proof. The mechanism is all about redirecting limited resources.
Okay, redirecting how?
Your brain only has so much blood flow and electrical energy to allocate at one time. So when you create that mindful pause, when you step back and observe the urge rather than being consumed by it, you are literally rerouting blood flow away from the emotional and craving centers like the insula and the DMN.
Wait, really?
Yes. You force that energy into the prefrontal cortex, which is the logical executive control center of your brain. By applying objective observation, you are physically starving the craving neural pathways of the oxygen and attention they need to survive.
That is fascinating. It feels like our brains are running on ancient survival software.
Exactly.
Because our ancestors needed these massive, overwhelming biological drives just to secure food, ensure safety, and find social belonging in a really dangerous world.
They were survival mechanisms.
Right. But today, we live in a modern world that is absolutely flooded with supernormal stimuli. Processed foods, infinite digital feeds, on-demand entertainment. It's like our ancient software is constantly being bombarded by modern supernormal pop-up ads.
That's a brilliant way to put it. And think about how software reacts to a malicious pop-up ad.
It totally freezes up.
Right, because the ad is designed to exploit the baseline coding of the operating system. It bypasses your logical firewalls by triggering a false sense of urgency, like saying your computer is infected or you need to click immediately to win something.
Oh, wow.
Supernormal stimuli do the exact same thing to our dopamine systems. They hijack the evolutionary pathways that were meant to keep us alive, convincing the nervous system that engaging in a harmful habit is a matter of immediate survival.
Which completely explains why the urge feels so existential in the moment.
Yes.
It feels like you will literally die if you don't give in, even though logically you know you won't.
Exactly.
And this brings us to a modern psychological approach the RAFT program references, which is acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT.
ACT, yes. A very powerful framework.
And ACT utilizes a concept called diffusion. But I want to be super clear on how diffusion actually operates cognitively. How does it separate us from these intense evolutionary thoughts?
Cognitive diffusion is basically the exact modern equivalent of saying, Mara, I know you.
Okay, how so?
Well, when we are in a state of fusion, we look from our thoughts. If the thought is, I am going to fail, we view the entire world through the lens of being a failure. It becomes an undeniable reality.
You just embody.
Right. But diffusion teaches you to look at your thoughts instead. You learn to observe them merely as mental events, just strings of words or transient images passing through your mind, not as objective truths or commands that you must obey.
So you change your relationship to the thought.
Yes, without trying to change the content of the thought itself.
So we aren't trying to rewrite the pop-up ad at all.
No.
We're just recognizing that it is an ad and choosing not to click.
Perfectly said.
And there's a profound philosophical layer to this as well, isn't there? Because the program touches on the philosopher Søren Kierkegaard.
It does. Kierkegaard wrote extensively about what he called the sickness of despair.
And how does that connect here?
Well, Kierkegaard defined this despair not just as sadness, but as the state of not knowing one's own true self.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And if we view that through the framework we're discussing today, it aligns perfectly with the concept of Mara.
Because Mara thrives on deception.
Exactly. Mara thrives in the domain of the false self. He gains all his leverage by keeping us bound to self-deception. He keeps us chained to whatever is familiar, our old coping mechanisms, even if those familiar things are causing us immense pain.
Simply because the brain prefers a predictable misery over an unpredictable freedom.
That is the tragic irony of it, yes.
That is a heavy but really vital realization. The brain prefers predictable misery over unpredictable freedom.
It does.
So what does this all mean for us on a practical level? I mean, it completely redefines what freedom actually looks like.
It really changes the whole paradigm.
Because we always think we need to fight our impulses to win. We think freedom means reaching a state where the pop-up ads just never appear, where we never feel a craving again.
But the RAFT program is telling us that freedom isn't the absence of triggers.
Right.
Freedom is the profound peace of non-engagement. It's the capacity to just sit at the table with your discomfort and not be bullied by it.
Not clicking the ad.
Exactly. It happens in that critical split second when a deliberate, chosen action replaces an instinctive evolutionary reaction.
It is a complete shift from warfare to wisdom. We are no longer going to war with our own minds. Mara is not someone to fight. Mara is someone to know.
Someone to know, yes.
And with each mindful pause, each time you sit there and say, I know you, those heavy chains of conditioning loosen just a fraction of an inch more.
They do.
And over time, that exhausting vigilance you've been carrying around turns from a stressful, hyper-alert state into a very calm, compassionate practice.
And you know, it is vital to remember that this isn't a one-and-done realization.
Good point.
Just as the ancient texts show Mara returning again and again throughout Gautama's entire life, these urges will revisit you. It requires the continuous cultivation of this practice.
For anyone listening who wants to cultivate this practice further and really explore the full depths of the framework, I highly recommend going straight to the materials. All of this comes from the RAFT to Freedom workbook, which is written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen.
They've put together something really special.
They really have. And they have done an incredible thing by making all 66 chapters of this workbook freely available online.
Which is amazing.
Truly.
Yeah.
You can find all this profound material at raft2freedom.org.
It is an invaluable resource. And as we bring our deep dive to a close today, I actually want to leave you with a gentle, self-reflective question straight from the RAFT program.
Okay, let's hear it.
As you go about your week, think about your own habits and ask yourself, when Mara succeeds in tricking me, when I do inevitably fall for the illusion, can I meet myself with kindness rather than self-criticism?
Kindness over criticism. That is where the real healing begins.
Absolutely.
I also want to share a final quote from the end of the chapter we've been exploring, spoken by Dr. Judson Brewer. He summarizes this entire journey perfectly, saying that true freedom comes from seeing really clearly what we get when we get caught up in our behaviors, becoming disenchanted on a visceral level, and from this disenchanted stance, naturally letting go.
It is all about letting go, not forcefully pushing away.
Exactly. And to leave you with one final thought to mull over. We've talked about how our brains are running ancient survival software in a modern world. But what if our brain's next evolutionary leap isn't about gaining more processing power or more intelligence?
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
What if the ultimate human mutation, our next stage of evolution, is simply the capacity to intentionally ignore our own internal programming? The next time you feel the intense pull of a harmful habit, consider that by simply pulling out a chair, inviting it to tea, and doing absolutely nothing, you might just be participating in the highest evolution of the human mind.